Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a real pleasure to introduce Gary Langer because I've been using his work so long. And in a world where not every poll has the proper sample or the proper questions or objective analysis, I've watched him work through Iraq, through Pakistan, through other countries, and provide, I think, a great deal of insight. And we keep using the phrase hearts and minds, and far too often it is a preference to expressing our heart or our mind rather than the hearts and minds of the people that we are really talking about. And so I think it's useful to come to the core of what people in the United States and Iraq think about this war and what is happening. And it is particularly useful to be able to combine them, to get an overview not only of U.S. public opinion, but Iraqi public opinion. So, Gary, with that brief introduction, let me turn things over to you.
Thank you, Tony. Thanks, Tony. Thanks, everyone, for coming. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. We have a wealth of data, first, of course, on U.S. public opinion, particularly as I'm going to present today, focused on the war in Iraq and its aftermath, and additionally on Iraqi public opinion of the war and its aftermath. And I'm going to present to you today on both of those subjects. We'll start with U.S. attitudes and then move on. I'm going to start with a short clip. This is from World News Tonight, broadcast early last month. Oh, sorry.
Let me go back to the Americans. Two-thirds of Americans say it's not worth fighting. And they're looking at the value gain versus the cost in American lives, certainly, and Iraqi lives.
So?
So? You don't care what the American people think?
No, I think you cannot be blown off course by the fluctuations in the public opinion polls.
We see in our first slide the fluctuations in the opinion polls on the war in Iraq in the last 14 months, in which steadily, over for more than the past year, anywhere from 59 to 66% of Americans have said in their judgment the war is not worth fighting. We can open it up a little to look at the fluctuations in the public opinion polls over the last 2 years, in which, again, steadily, a majority of Americans, in this case from 55 to 66%, have said the war in Iraq, in their judgment, is not worth fighting. We can open it up further to the time of the war itself, just 5 years ago, and look at the course of public opinion over this period of time. Now, these attitudes are highly partisan. 68% of Republicans in our most recent data have called the war worth fighting, and no fewer than 63% have said so continuously since the war began. No fewer than 63%. On the other hand, 85% of Democrats and 65% of Republicans describe the war as not worth fighting. So we have highly partisan views. In aggregate, though, this has been their course. As we can see, a majority steadily now for the past 3.5 years have described the war in Iraq as not worth fighting. I want to probe with you and examine some of the judgments that create these attitudes and some of the consequences of the attitudes that are formed as a result. A first point, though, I think we should add is the intensity of these views. We measure not only overall public attitudes on this as other issues, but the intensity, the depth of feeling with which those attitudes are held. Continuously, we've seen strongly negative views of the war. Outnumber and generally far outnumber strongly positive views of the war, in which, particularly for the last long while, about twice as many Americans say they strongly feel that the war was not worth fighting as feel that it was worth fighting. President Bush's handling of the war, as you can see, has been started quite positive at the start. You see a blip in his favor at the time of the capture of Saddam Hussein, in which considered judgment hoped, I think, that this would represent real progress. It didn't last. We went flipped to a majority negative report. Now, for more than the past 4 years, majority of Americans, again, steadily have given the president negative ratings for his handling of the situation in Iraq, with, again, particularly in the last period, a substantial amount of stability in those attitudes, in which you could define public opinion on the war and on the president's handling of it is essentially locked in cement. They really haven't changed much at all over the last year, certainly, and in, give me a little latitude over the last 2 years. We seek in this measurement what we call considered judgment, which is our understanding of the formation of public opinion. Public opinion polls are sometimes described as a snapshot in time. I prefer to describe them as a portrait. A snapshot is an amateur product. A portrait is a more serious undertaking to understand and capture an image. But public attitudes as well are sometimes thought of as being flighty, as jumping up and down with events. Rather, there's been very substantial work that defines and describes public opinion as the product of considered judgment. That is, citizens making an ongoing assessment of the facts on the ground and the information available to them over time, forming opinions and attitudes on their assessment of the facts and information. And when the facts and information change, going into a period of reassessment, that either does or does not produce a change in attitudes. The question we ask, seeking considered judgment on the war in Iraq, is as follows. All in all, considering the costs to the United States versus the benefits to the United States, do you think the war in Iraq was worth fighting or not? Or do you feel that way strongly? We're encouraging an assessment, if you will. The elements that I think go into this assessment in our own reading of the data, our own understanding of public attitudes, and others as well. The cost would include, of course, casualties, dollars, goodwill, international reputation. Benefits, including security, perhaps also international reputation, other potential benefits. The issues of the necessity of the war, a clear purpose, a well-defined enemy, winnability, and exit strategy, and whether there's an absence or presence of international consensus. All these are elements that go into these judgments of whether the war, in this case, was or was not worth fighting. It's not solely about the level of casualties, but whether a persuasive rationale has been presented for sustaining them. And if you're interested in more on this subject, I'd recommend the two sources I have listed at the bottom. They're both very good. So let's take a look at some of the elements that go into this judgment by Americans of whether the war is worth fighting. First, has the war contributed to long-term U.S. security, perhaps its most fundamental rationale? And we see a conflicted answer. An early start, yes, a substantial majority thought it had. And that's wobbled since for really quite a long period of time, as you can see, where to the point where most recently we've had half or a little over half fairly consistently saying they thought that it had not, slightly under saying that it had. I would suggest, though, that the more important line in opinion judgment and opinion formation is the bottom line, which is the number of Americans who've said that it's contributed a great deal to long-term U.S. security. As you can see, that's been pretty stable, pretty much right along, at around a quarter, around 25% or just under 30% of Americans. And the question then is whether that sort of lower level contribution to security justifies the costs. Is the U.S. making progress in restoring civil order in Iraq, which might be viewed as a winnability question at this point? Fluctuations, again, you can see a spike up toward yes, a very short-lived with the capture of Saddam Hussein in 2003, I'm sorry. That spike was the elections, I beg your pardon. That 1205 spike was the legislative elections. Didn't last. There's some significant deterioration after the Samarra Golden Mosque bombing, and the country went into great disarray. In the period of the surge, there was some improvement in that perception. It is, in our last poll, actually turned back around somewhat. This notion, having broken it, we've bought it, we need to stay in Iraq because it's our responsibility to restore the country to order, having invaded it, reached, I think this was a persuasive, and to some extent still is, but it was a quite persuasive attribute of public perspectives on the war from the beginning for a longer while than some of the other measures we see, but reached what I think is a very significant turn and tipping point there right around and just after December 2006, when we saw a majority of Americans conclude that given the ongoing and seemingly intractable problems, that it was more important to withdraw U.S. forces, no time frame is given here, to avoid further casualties than to remain in Iraq until civil order is restored. And we see that has continued, again, with, since the change, a good amount of stability for the last while. Must the U.S. win the war in Iraq in order to win the broader U.S. campaign against terrorism? An argument we've heard posited by political leaders, and that's an argument that over most of 2007, and increasingly in our most recent data, which was from about 2 weeks ago, Americans don't buy into it. Casualties, as I pointed out previously, don't in and of themselves dictate public attitudes on war. The question is whether there's been a persuasive rationale for sustaining those casualties. In the absence, though, of a persuasive rationale, the casualties are a powerful influence. And we see here accumulated U.S. casualties, cumulative casualties in Iraq since the beginning of the war, and the view that the war was not worth fighting. And they correlate quite strongly at point nine. Now, you can say that any two lines that go up can be said to correlate, but I think the point is that both these lines are going up. What are the political consequences, then, of this ultimately negative, long-term now negative public judgment in the United States on whether the war in Iraq has been worth fighting? We can look at the career job approval of George W. Bush. Spikes after 9/11 and really had a lot of sustain in it. It looks like a fairly steep down, but that was over quite a long period of time. Up again after the war and then steeply down. After, you know, the president's visit to the aircraft carrier, the mission accomplished visit, was just 5 years ago tomorrow. I think that helped create a public perception that the conflict indeed was over. And when that became, it became clear that this wasn't the case, we saw this very steep decline in the president's approval rating. Maintained just over 50%, slipping under the wire just in time to get reelected. And then his approval rating continued down. His latest 33%. Talk about fluctuations in the polls. The president has had either 32 or 33% of approval rating from Americans in the last nine ABC News, Washington Post polls since last July. It hasn't exceeded 36% approval in over a year and a half. And indeed has been, as we'll see, in the doghouse in terms of public attitudes longer than any other post-war president. This zeroes in a little if we just look at the course of his approval rating since the start of the war, that sharp downward turn, and it continues down. He gets through the election, and down we go. If we want to look at the proximate cause of these declines in the president's approval rating, it's hard to ignore this chart, which tracks the view that the war was worth fighting and approval of the president's performance in office. And I think you'll agree that these sentiments are essentially joined at the hip. That's really an uncanny level of correlation, and it leads me to conclude that, as I like to put it, hell hath no fury like an unpopular war. One consequence, as I mentioned previously, is that in our most recent poll, the president has now racked up the longest continuous term under 50% approval of any post-war president, 39 months, beating the previous record holder, Harry Truman, by a month, with some time left in President Bush's term. Truman, of course, had economic difficulties as well as an unpopular war of his own. I think it was right around 1952 when I saw some data finding that 56% of Americans thought that war in Korea was not worth fighting. In looking, though, and trying to understand the president's approval rating and the influence of the war on his rating, it occurred to us to look back at the most recent president who found himself enmeshed in an unpopular war. And we thought we'd do a comparison with Lyndon Johnson. And I think that this chart as well is quite striking. What we do is we track here each of these presidents' average approval ratings in each year of their terms in office. And you can, if you first focus on Johnson, you can see he took office with quite a lot of popularity, maintained it, and then saw a significant drop, which continued as the country became further enmeshed in Vietnam. The relationship to President Bush's ratings are really quite, again, uncanny, in which he takes office with the same very high approval rating his first year in office, boosted by that rally of support after 9/11, and then sees it start down and then decline rapidly as the nation became enmeshed in the conflict in Iraq. Two very different conflicts in nature, in intensity, in casualties, in many other ways, but both unpopular and both with similar, very similar effects on presidential popularity. The only difference, of course, is that President Bush has more time to suffer. But take a look at the political, now the electoral, if you will, impacts of these sorts of attitudes. In our 2004 exit poll, as I mentioned, President Bush, in effect, with his popularity, slipped under the wire just over majority popularity in time to get reelected. And indeed, in our 2004 exit poll, we found that 51% of Americans approved of the war in Iraq. By the time of the 2006 midterm elections, that had flipped. There was a 9-point drop in approval of the war and an 11-point increase in disapproval. 56% disapproved of the war in 2006. In the 2006 election, among people who approved of the war, 80% voted Republican. Among people who disapproved of the war, 80% voted Republican, the voted Democrat. The fact that a majority in the 2006 election had decided that they disapproved of the war produced a Democratic majority in the vote. You can see the overall vote at the bottom went from 47-49 Dem rep to 53-45, a really dramatic shift, and produced 31 seats in the House and control of the House and Senate for the Democrats. These are, I think, the consequences fueled far more than any other force we've been able to identify by public attitudes about the conflict in Iraq. I'm going to jump to give you one more example of the impact of this war on the politics in the United States, and then we'll move on to Iraq itself. This chart is, to me, a fundamental one for understanding politics in this country. This is a generation of data, more than 600,000 interviews in ABC News polls since 1981. I think 82 just shows up. Showing party ID in this country, the number of Americans who identify themselves as Democrats, Republicans, or Independents. This is in many ways the most fundamental measure of political allegiance in the country. We started out with a very significant Democratic advantage in party ID, which over the years, with fits and starts, but gradually declined as Republican self-identification gradually increased. I think an inescapable conclusion of this chart is to say that the Republicans had, over the last generation, the more compelling political message. They attracted more adherents to their side over this generation of discourse, particularly so regionally in the South. I'm not going to do a political presentation. This occurred to the point in 2003 where, for the first time, these are annual averages in our data, very stable data set, where the first time in 2003 we reached absolute parity in party ID. Quite a change if you look back from 1981. 31% of Americans that year on average defined themselves as Democrats, 31% as Republicans. And if these trends line continued, we would expect and have expected to see Republicans start then to outnumber Democrats in this country. 2003, by coincidence, perhaps the year we go to war with Iraq. Let's take a look at the trends in party ID since. Starting in 2003 and just after, an increase, then a leveling, in Democratic self-identification, a significant downturn in Republican self-identification, growth in independence. A turning away from the president that we saw earlier, accompanied by a turning away from the president's party in the aftermath of the unpopular war in Iraq. If we project these lines into the future, always a dicey proposition, but let's give it a shot, using the accumulated data of these last 27 years, 27 years, sorry, we do find, again, Democrats and Republicans reaching parity in about 2021, after which, presumably, if the past did foretell the present, you'd have Republicans starting to outnumber Democrats once again. But the effect, if you will, of the change we've seen in the last 5 years since the war is to push that point back about 11 years. All right. Political consequences in this country. Now let's turn to Iraq. We've conducted 5 national public opinion polls in Iraq with various media partners. The field dates are there. Sample sizes, N is the sample size of these surveys and the number of sampling points. Let me give you one point of comparison. An exit poll, take California. California is a state that happens to be about the same size in area and about the same population as Iraq. When we do an exit poll in the state of California, which in some ways is akin to a face-to-face national survey, it is likely to have 40 to 50 individual sampling points, randomly selected points from which respondents are then randomly selected for interviewing. 40 or 50 points. My most recent poll in Iraq, the one at the bottom, had 461 individual sampling points. That means we had an extraordinary level of geographical distribution within the country. These are very high quality, rigorous, random sample surveys conducted via probability sampling and face-to-face interviews by Iraqis in Iraq. We do these polls because we want to report on what is occurring in Iraq, and we find this approach an essential way to do so. Our interviewers can get to areas of Iraq where we can't go as reporters, or where we would not be accepted if we could go as reporters. Any interview between a Western correspondent or reporter and individuals in Iraq is going to be filtered by that cultural difference of which both participants will clearly be aware. Rather, we can do these interviews from the Turkish border to the Persian Gulf with our Iraqi interviewers interviewing Iraqis in their native language using an instrument, a questionnaire, designed to read and to sound as if it were a survey of Iraqis by Iraqis for Iraqis, without any of the participants being aware of the Western sponsorship of the survey, so we can get a truly independent, even-handed, neutral evaluation of public attitudes there. And when I talk about doing this reporting and going to these places, Naja, Babel, these are actual interviews from the fieldwork for our most recent survey. Okay, so what do we find? This data point goes back to 2005 when we found substantial positivity in public attitudes in Iraq. 71% of Iraqis said their own lives are going pretty well, and expectations were high for improvements for the country in the year ahead. February 06th, if I'm right, is the bombing of the Golden Mosque in Samarra. The country declines into significant disarray. We go back into the field in March and we found deep declines, a real spiral downward in these sentiments. These are basic fundamental sentiments of public attitudes, if you will. You're satisfied how things are going in your life and your expectations for the country's future. We go back 6 months later, which was in effect bracketing the initial stages of the surge, and we find, if any, some of these worse, and certainly no improvement. We go back again in our most recent survey completed late February of this year, and we do find improvement. Not to the level that we saw in November 05, much less to the level we might hope for in other countries or in this country, but we do find improvement. That improvement seems to be rooted in improved security, in improved commerce, and improved economic opportunity. In this case, a couple of these data points go back to 2004. We saw a little bit of improvement from 04 to 05, pretty good ratings in 05. Your family's economic situation, the availability of household goods, local security, dramatic declines in March and again in August 2007, a very difficult year in that country. And then very sharp gains, 65% of Iraqis. And perhaps I think one of the single biggest improvements in the country, rate the ability, the availability of household goods positively in our most recent survey. Economic situation and security, notably, as well, as up. In another example, we ask Iraqis to rate security in their country in the past 6 months. The most dramatic gain here is in the middle bars, in which the number of Iraqis who say things in their country are getting worse. 61% last August, 6 months into the surge, a truly negative assessment at that point, drops dramatically to the point now where just 26% say things in their country are still getting worse. This is a significant improvement, a significant gain in conditions in the country. And the number who say it's getting better, while perhaps less inspiring than we might wish, up from 11 to 36%. Again, a dramatic improvement in our last 6 months. We drill down, as I will again and again in this presentation, to specific locales in the country. And we can see here that a lot of these gains were focused in two specific locales, Baghdad and Anbar province. The number of Baghdad residents who rated their local security positively in our August 2007 poll was none, and that increased to 43%, a very sharp increase. Likewise, positive ratings of their economic situation in Baghdad, very sharply up. In Anbar as well, sharp increases in these two. In the rest of the country, both of these started considerably better and gained, but far less sharply. There's a real focus of the improvements that we've been discussing in Baghdad and Anbar. Again, if we disaggregate the positive ratings of local security by locale, we can see some very dramatic differences in our most recent data. And this, I think, is where we get to start getting to more troubling data, less good news, if you will. The fact that the improvements in security, or at least the positive ratings in security, I should say, are not at all evenly distributed in the country. That there are areas of great positivity in terms of local security, and there are areas of very significant difficulty, some of which we know about. If you look at Sulaymaniyah, Erbil, Dikar has been a garden spot in many ways for security. We talked about Baghdad, and that's a sharp improvement from 0 to 43%, but it's still a majority negative in Baghdad. And then let's look at Kirkuk, Nineveh, Diyala, and the very difficult situation in Mosul. Interestingly, positive ratings of the availability of goods is much more evenly distributed in the country. While we can see that great unevenness in security, commerce is more evenly distributed and better. Not perfectly evenly distributed. There's still some dramatic differences here between Mosul and Nineveh, those trouble spots we just saw, and the Kurdish north. But still, I think the infrastructure of the company of the country, the elimination of many roadblocks, the freer ability to transport goods has had a dramatic effect. This is seen as well, perhaps, median monthly income. These are not inflation-adjusted. I don't have a good adjustment measure, but we show, interestingly, we show a sharp increase from 04 to 05 to 07, then it levels as we have that period of difficulty last year, and an increase again in the median house, median monthly household income. Other measures of material gains show dramatic improvement in Iraq, particularly from the beginning or earliest data. The number of Iraqis who report having a cell phone, 6%, when we first polled on the subject, 91% now. It's really quite an astonishing change in that country. Ownership of radios, washing machines, cars, computers, up sharply. On the other hand, while there's an increase, the number of Iraqis who report having electricity supply in their home for more than 12 hours a day is still just 21%. Internet access is low as well. And these get us, I think, or underscore some of the infrastructure problems I now want to talk to you about. We saw a recent report this week about the effectiveness of reconstruction and the $100 billion spent, I think, in Iraq. Iraqis themselves, only 23% describe the reconstruction efforts in their areas as effective. Only 4% describe them as very effective. versus the ineffective numbers. Even in the best locales, as you can see there, Basra City, Babil, Erbil, Dikar again, and Sulaymaniyah, in most of those, we still don't have a majority rating the reconstruction efforts positively. This is reflected well as well in ratings by Iraqis of their living conditions. Gains from 04 to 05, dramatic declines in 07, flat from March to August 07, and improvements, but hardly to the level that we might want since that time. The freedom of movement, 44% of Iraqis now say they can move about safely where they wish. 38% say they're able to live where they want without the fear of persecution. That means 62% say they're not. Medical care, in a really, I think, troubling decline. Back in 05, 62% of Iraqis said they had adequate or good access to decent medical care. That's today 38%. I think fueled, among other things, by an exodus of doctors and those who had the wherewithal to leave the country. Only 30% of Iraqis say they have an adequate supply of clean water. The jobs is not rated positively. Fuel and, of course, electricity, as we discussed, is a very persistent problem. These are, as I say, less positive ratings of the situation in Iraq. For all the expenditure on infrastructure development, we see relatively little payback, and it's very significant continued problems. Again, if we take some of these and disaggregate it by locale, and by the way, it's sort of an odd mix of locales I have there. I basically have selected those for which we have an adequate subsample for reliable analysis. So they include a smattering of individual provinces in the country, and also a few individual cities beyond Baghdad where we conducted oversamples, Kirkuk, Mosul, Anbar City as well. I'm sorry, not Anbar, Basra City. Anbar is a province. Look at the ratings of the freedom of movement. Very positive in some of the areas. Interestingly, very positive in Sadr City and in Anbar and in Sulaymaniyah in the north. But then if we look down again to some of the more recent trouble spots in Kirkuk, Diyala, Babil, in Nineveh, in Mosul, notably in Basra, real problems. So we have seen improvements in security. We have not seen improvements, or I think what might be fairly described as sufficient improvements, in some other areas. What credit does the United States get for the improvement in security we've seen? And what are the views of the United States more broadly? Well, first, the Awakening Councils, a product of the United States policy, do receive fairly positive ratings. 51% of Iraqis say they've made things better in terms of security. Only 16% say they've made things worse. Fairly uniquely in Iraq, as we'll see as we go through the data, it's a subject in which a substantial majority of Sunnis are positive, as well as half of Shiites, fewer Kurds. It's not a slide I'm putting up, but indeed confidence in the security councils, the Awakening Councils, I should say, is higher than confidence in the national government overall, because there's less sectarianism in this view. At the same time, when we ask Iraqis in an open-ended question who they give credit for improved security in the country, the Iraqi government, army, and police are by far most frequently named. The councils themselves, the al-Sahawa, 8%. U.S. forces, as you can see at the end, 4%. Very little credit given to the United States for creating these councils, which are credited with the improvements in security. Why might this be? Well, there's good and bad news here. There's an increase in the number of Iraqis who say that the United States was right to invade their country in the first place, but just to 49%, still just under half. And some of the following ratings are perhaps more troubling than that. 36% of Iraqis say U.S. forces have improved security in their country. That's double what it was in August. That's a dramatic increase, but it's still 36%, 64% say otherwise. Only 26% of Iraqis support the presence of U.S. forces in their country, and that's barely budged. 29% approve of the performance of U.S. forces. That's improved, but still at a quite low level. And of real concern is the fact that while it's improved, 42% of Iraqis still call it acceptable in their view to attack U.S. forces. down from a majority, but still, it's 42%. That's a lot of hostility. We look at it by sectarianism, and we'll visit this more. The data speak for themselves. The Sunnis are still seething. The Kurds are overjoyed. And the Shiites are basically pleased with the invasion in the first place. Yet, a tipping point, I think, is in the views on attacks on U.S. forces. While there's been a dramatic improvement in the number of Sunnis who call attacks on U.S. forces acceptable, still 62% do, as do 43% of Shiites, even though two-thirds of them say the U.S. was right to invade for obvious reasons. Kurds are different. If we look at it by locale, the administration, I think, has in some cases presented its progress in Anbar as a winning of hearts and minds in that province. And while there has been undeniable progress in the provision of security in Anbar, still two-thirds in Anbar, down from 100%, perceive it as acceptable to attack U.S. forces. That is one of the biggest improvements, but it's still a lot of hostility. Improvement in Diyala as well. I don't have trend data for Mosul, but as you can see overall, there are a lot of areas where majorities of Iraqis or substantial minorities see these attacks as acceptable. It is interesting, nonetheless, that despite this expressed hostility, so many Iraqis do see a continued role for the United States in their country in providing security against al-Qaeda, in assisting with military training, in providing aid for reconstruction, in providing security vis-a-vis Iran and vis-a-vis Turkey. Not only do majorities of Iraqis support a continued role for the United States in each of these areas, so indeed do a majority, except for the last, of Sunnis in Iraq. Sunnis, the group most hostile to the United States presence in their country, support two-thirds or more in many of these cases a U.S. role in the future of their country. The difference, of course, is this is perceived as an invited role. Turning, I think, to challenges that, internal challenges, if you will, and there are many for the government of Iraq, we have the conflict of the presence of militias in the country and the perception, in many cases, that they are as strong as or stronger than the government itself. The overall bars on the left, the ones I put the numbers on, across the country, we ask Iraqis to rate the strength of government forces in this area, in their own local area, we're speaking to their own experience, to ask them to rate the strength of local militia, and they're rated very nearly as powerfully, as strongly. A challenge, I think, to the government's credentials in terms of being the commanding force in the country and, of course, in specific areas. Take a look at Sadr City, right, where the government forces are seen as strong by about half the population and the militia by about everyone. Interestingly, if you go down, you can get to Baghdad. That's Baghdad. The ratings of militia forces are so strong in Baghdad solely because of their strength, perceived strength in Sadr City. That's where they are. Again, you can see the areas where the government, in effect, has or is perceived as having control, having the stronger presence, and they are quite few and far between. Dhekar might be a good place to spend vacation, but that's about it. If we look at another measure, not the presence or the strength of government versus militia forces, but simply as confidence in local militia by locale, we can again see a very dramatic level of differences across the country with that very strong level of confidence in militia in Sadr City. In the rest of Baghdad, it's 5%. Versus 70% in Sadr City. But by and large, local militia are not a source of confidence for Iraqis. They're not desired you might say, as a force, perhaps except in Sadr City. But they are there and perceived as a force. It's a real challenge for the country. All right, so I've shown you some differences between Sunnis and Shias. I want to get into that a little further, and this question of governance for the country. First of all, I think a fundamental question is the population parameters, Sunni, Shia, and Kurd in Iraq. There are three sources of data. The one most frequently cited that I've seen is the CIA World Factbook, which uses presents population estimates that are unsourced. I don't know where they came from. Another is a book called Iraq, A Country Study, which is published by the Library of Congress in 1988. Its estimate, too, is not sourced. It's actually described as knowledgeable observers. Since it matches up so well with the CIA World Factbook estimate, I assume that the CIA World Factbook estimate came from this Library of Congress study, but I can't say that for sure. And then we have our data, drawn in this case from three most recent polls. It's nearly 7,000 interviews from more than 1,400 sampling points, nearly 1,400 sampling points across the country. The CIA World Factbook puts the Shiite population of Iraq at 60 to 65%, same as the Library of Congress unsourced estimates. And ours has it at 49%. And it's interesting, I think, because Iraq is frequently and for many years been described as a majority Shiite country. Our estimates are otherwise. I do know there have been some surveys conducted in Iraq which have been forced to these unsourced estimates of population. I don't think that's justified. You're welcome to accept the estimate you like best, but I can tell you that personally I like data. In any case, for fun, we've taken our data and adjusted it to the population parameters given by the Library of Congress and CIA sources. And while they change a little at the margins, they don't fundamentally change our understanding of the divisions of opinion in the country. Let's look at the sectarian divide. Today, most recently in our February 24th poll, the number of Iraqis who say their own life is going well, there's an enormous gap between Sunnis, Shiites, and then Kurds. Those who say the country's prospects are good, or the things in the country are going well, 83% of Sunnis are negative on the conduct of affairs in the country, as are nearly 4 in 10 Shiites, but and a majority of Kurds. But still, the disaffection of Sunni Arabs in the country is quite striking and continues to be. And the last one is fairly devastating as well. Only 12% of Sunni Arabs say they expect a better life for their children. Far more positive among Shiites and Kurds, although again, perhaps not as positive as one might wish. Confidence in national institutions, far shorter among Sunnis in terms of the Iraqi army. Sunni confidence in the national government at only 10%, and local leaders 22%. Kurds at the high end, Shiites broadly, generally positive. And Sunnis deeply disaffected. Approval of Maliki, confidence in the local militias, not high in any of these groups, but particularly so among the Sunnis. Interestingly, therefore, a majority across these groups, although a greater majority of Sunnis, do continue to support the concept of a unified country with a central government in Baghdad. This is one of the positive results for the country's governance. We'll look at a few others. Despite the difficulties, there is still a sentiment of nationalism, if you will, in Iraqi attitudes involving majorities of Sunnis and Shiites as well. Kurds are another story. But this was the first time in our 5 Iraq polls in which a majority, although narrow majority, but a majority of Kurds, they prefer to see a separate Iraq broken up into separate independent states. I will tell you that we came out of the field shortly before the real increase in Turkish incursions against the PKK in the north. I don't know if that might have led Kurds to reassess their desire for independence, but it's certainly worth revisiting. On the PKK, I think the antipathy of Sunni Arabs for the United States is also reflected in their antipathy toward the Kurds in the north, perhaps, and vice versa. The two-thirds of Sunnis see Turkish incursions against the PKK as justified. Most Shiites disagree. Perhaps surprisingly, more than a third of Kurds agree as well. So I don't know that the PKK has the base of support or the depth of support in Kurdistan that might be assumed. And indeed, in a similar result, the notion that the Iraqi government is not doing enough to control the activities of the PKK is endorsed by 8 in 10 Sunnis and a majority of Shiites and a third of Kurds as well. I want to talk about personal experiences of violence in Iraq among the population, because this, again, does inform the judgments and the opinions and attitudes we've seen. These are measures of experiences of violence. Has each of the following occurred in this local area? We're sitting in your living room asking you about it. Not ever, but in this case, simply in the past 6 months. These are past 6 months responses. The ever responses are much larger. Even since the success of the surge started to show effect in our last poll from August to February. So this is a February data. We're only looking back to August. We still find that a quarter or just over a quarter of Iraqis report suicide bombs, car bombs, or suicide attacks in their local area. Snipers and crossfire going down that first column, sectarian fighting, unnecessary violence by U.S. forces, by militia, forced separation of people, all reported by substantial numbers, not majorities by any sense, but by substantial numbers of Iraqis as having occurred in their local area in the past 6 months. And to show you the variation by locale, I'm putting in some of the highs on the right, partly to show that this is not solely, as sometimes has been suggested, a Baghdad phenomenon. Car bombs and suicide attacks within the past 6 months reported by 61% in Baghdad, snipers and crossfire by 58% in Mosul, sectarian fighting by 58% in Diyala, the violence, unnecessary violence perceived by U.S. forces and by militia in Anbar and in Basra, the majorities there. Forced separation of people does appear to have been focused by far in Baghdad and Basra. It's much lower in the rest of the country. These are substantial levels of violence, and I sometimes ask correspondents at my shop to reflect on American public opinions if these sorts of attacks, this experience of violence was occurring in this country. And even perhaps if it were reduced, if we had gone from several hundred car bombings in a month in a period of time down to only a few dozen in the next period of time, would that be seen as a success? Would it be seen as acceptable to the population? And if not here, why would it there? This goes back to our March 07 poll. We haven't repeated it, but will at some point, in which 53% of Iraqis reported that a friend or member of their immediate family had been physically harmed by the violence occurring in the country. This is one unfortunate result in which Sunnis and Shiites were in accord, in agreement. About 6 in 10 in both those groups reported this sort of violence, a personal experience, if you will, and much lower in the far more pacified Kurdish north. These experiences have consequences. These are classic measures of traumatic stress. Symptoms, not diagnoses by any means, but symptoms of stress disorder include feelings of anger, depression, trouble sleeping, and difficulty concentrating. We find that very sizable majorities of Iraqis reported each of these, and significant minorities, a third or so, reported each of them severely, to the point where in our last measure, the last two bars on the right, 7 in 10 Iraqis reported experiencing these stress levels, and 1 in 5 a great deal. Again, it's worth remeasuring. One thing we know from our own polling in 9/11 is that symptoms of stress, when the cause of the stress is alleviated, tend to diminish fairly rapidly across large areas of the population, although they do leave pockets of more significant and ongoing damage. But this is a public health concern, and is something not to be disregarded. And next, I'll leave you with a few thoughts. One is some positive news in views on reconciliation. I mentioned that I think about 1 in 7 Iraqis report the forced separation of individuals. That's within their own mahalla, within their own neighborhood. Nonetheless, 92%, vast majority of Sunnis and Shiites alike, describe this forced separation of peoples as bad for the country. It's not desired. 7 in 10 support government jobs for mid or low-level Baathists, a subject of debate and discussion in the country. Indeed, 6 in 10, more than 6 in 10, Shiites support giving government jobs to former Baathists. A clear indication of reconciliation in that population. Fewer Kurds, and there is antipathy there, but still 45% support such jobs. 9 in 10 Iraqis say Sunnis who did not widely participate in the last round of elections should participate in the next round of elections. And interestingly, even more, 95% of Sunnis say they themselves should take up participation in voting. Positive signs in this result. A perhaps less positive one is the separation we've discussed of these peoples. 54% of Iraqis report that they live in Shiite-only or Sunni-only areas. And another 3 in 10 say they live in mostly, predominantly Shiite or Sunni areas. Only 15% of Iraqis report themselves as living in mixed areas, and that even though Baghdad is a quarter of the population of the country. So the separation that's occurred in Baghdad is reflected in these data. And the separation of peoples is hard to see as a positive on the road to reconciliation. Looking more geopolitically, there are some interesting parallels, if I could just maybe bring them together in my last couple of slides, in Iraqi and American attitudes. As noted, only a quarter of Iraqis support the presence of U.S. forces in their country. Given the conditions in the country, I don't think that's a hard data point to understand. There's, of course, a sharp sectarian difference, 5% of Sunnis, 23% of Shiites. Kurds have a completely different attitude toward the United States, as we've discussed, again, for clear reasons. Similarly, on this side of the world, only, as discussed, 34% of Americans say the war has been worth fighting. And we have our own, not ethno-sectarian, but political sectarian differences, if you will. The differences by partisanship that I discussed earlier, in which only 13% of Democrats call the war worth fighting. Only 3 in 10 independents, but 6 in 4 Republicans. All right, so we're not happy. Bottom line, if you take these populations in aggregate, only 26% of Iraqis support the presence of U.S. forces. Only 34% of Americans say the war was worth fighting. It seems like the simple conclusion is to split. But we don't find that sentiment, and we don't find it in either population. 38% of Iraqis, for all their antipathy toward the United States and all the difficulty they've experienced in their country, just 38% of Iraqis say the United States should withdraw now, again, with very sharp sectarian or ethno-sectarian differences. Even fewer in the United States, 17%, favor the immediate withdrawal of U.S. forces. Withdrawal is favored, but immediate, only 17%, with less differences by partisanship. What this suggests, I think, in conclusion, is what we have here is two populations sort of locked in a relationship with which both are deeply dissatisfied and deeply unhappy, but with which neither seems capable of envisioning a better alternative. It would seem to me to be a situation that cries out for leadership, for political leadership, but at least in the attitudes of these publics, it seems that the leaders as well are perceived as having been thus far unable to propose a tenable alternative. And with that less than cheerful conclusion, I'll take your questions. Thank you very much.
Gary, thank you very, very much. Let me, ladies and gentlemen, make two points. One, the briefing will be on the web. I believe, in fact, it already is. So if you need to get the numbers and statistics and you want them accurately, Gary's been kind enough to allow us to make them available to you. Second, let me open things up for a few questions. The usual drill, please wait for the microphone. When you stand up, do give your name and organization. And I would be very grateful if all of the questions asked actually ended in a question mark, and if they had less than 9 independent parts. So with that, let's begin. The gentleman there.
Nathaniel Hurd with the International Rescue Committee. As you know, there's been a lot of displacement in Iraq. Millions of people as refugees, millions of people displaced inside of the country, and a lot of vulnerable people who have been able to flee. Has ABC or any of the other outlets that do significant polling polled Americans about their awareness of the humanitarian situation in Iraq and in the region, and then their opinions about it? Stakes obviously very high for Iraqis and for stability in Iraq and the region.
We try to take into account in our population sampling within Iraq as best we can. The movement of peoples does make it sampling within a country challenging. But in terms of our U.S. polling, we haven't measured attitudes about, or knowledge, which is difficult to measure in opinion polling, about the refugee situation, or attitudes about it, because it's hard to believe that anyone would view it anything but negatively. One thing we did ask in our most recent Iraq poll is we asked Iraqis about the proprietorship issue, which is under significant debate in Iraq right now. That is, if people have left their homes in Iraq and others have moved in, and a conflict, that dispute arises, who should ownership go to, the family that left or the family that came in? And there is a very broad and cross-sectarian support for ownership remaining with the original family. Does that help?
Hi, Ron Brown, City National Journal. Garrett, I'm wondering, have you any data that would compare how Iraqis view Iran versus how they view the United States? And role they'd like to see in the country, in Iraq, both countries.
Right. Predictably, which is why I think I didn't present it today, strictly sectarian attitudes on Iran, as you might expect. The Sunni and Shia divisions on that question are simply precisely what you might expect in pretty much polar opposites. But there is, don't forget, a strong sense of nationalism within Iraq that still exists. We saw it in that majority support across these groups for continued existence of Iraq as a unified country, a single nation with a central government. So there is, across these groups, a desire for a separation, for independence, for self-determination for Iraq, regardless of whether their views of Iran are positive or negative.
Just an overall, do you have an overall positive, negative on each country, and how would they compare? And do you have a question about which whether you want either of them to have more of a role in sort of shaping Iraq's future?
Right, I do. I don't have the data points with me, but we have that not only for United States and for Iran, but for Saudi Arabia and Syria as well, and I'll be happy to get them to you. But they are very strictly sectarian in view.
Third row.
Steve Naplin, Business Executives for National Security. I wondered what measures you took, if any, to assess the extent to which a Shiite, when speaking with someone they believe to be a Shiite pollster, would give the sort of politically expedient answer to a question such as, who do you credit with improving security in Sadr City, something like that, where in their heart of hearts, maybe they recognize it is the American surge, but wouldn't dare say so to a Shiite, and therefore credit al-Sadr.
There are going to be undeniable difficulties in carrying out this kind of research in a crisis zone, if not a war zone. We do our best to iron that out of the fieldwork. We do, when possible, Shia interviewers are assigned to Shia mahallas, the Shia neighborhoods, Sunni interviewers to Sunni neighborhoods, and interestingly, perhaps, the interviewers who go to mixed neighborhoods, as a matter of security, I'm allowed to tell you, carry dual forms of identification with separate Shia and Sunni sounding names for use if stopped at roadblocks so they can be safe. The interviewers are highly trained. Every interviewer we use in our project has been through many previous survey research projects for D3 Systems, the field house that did this most recent work for us. We get the best and most honest answers we can. I guess it's about that simple. We can look at them across locale by a sectarian group, and we get answers that seem to be coherent and that seem to fit into our larger or broader understanding of the situation there. Social acceptability, while it can be presumed by onlookers, really exists in the eye of the beholder. It depends what your expectations of what is and isn't socially acceptable are. By and large, we find and believe in our survey research that individuals do tend to be honest and to give you straightforward answers. It is difficult and complicated to engage in subterfuge about your true attitudes, and the likelier result of that is if you don't want to participate would be not to participate at all. We do have really good cooperation rates on this survey, although not as good as we did originally. When we did our first poll in Iraq, our cooperation rate, the number of individuals randomly approached to participate who actually did, was over 90%. If they gained anything from the invasion, and they gained many things, one certainly would be the freedom of expression. Our most recent poll, I think the cooperation rate was down to around 64 or 65%, still a good, credible cooperation rate, and far better than we get, for example, in our surveys here in the United States. But I think fundamentally, if you don't want to answer the questions, if you think you're going to need to engage in subterfuge, you're more likely not to participate in the first place.
I think I should add, too, that when you look at somewhat similar polls in Afghanistan, what is rather striking is that even though the Afghan police aren't even present in many areas, and the Afghan army is far less developed than the Iraqi army, it is the Afghan forces which most Afghans credit with bringing security. There are two explanations for this. One of them is simply nationalism. You don't give foreigners credit. The other is something which is a little harder, and Gary touched on it but didn't get into depth. For us, we tend to think, obviously, of either the Taliban or the Al-Qaeda as the threat. In statistical terms, far more people in Afghanistan and Iraq experience hostile confrontations with U.S. and allied forces than they do with the enemy. Checkpoints, searches, people breaking into houses. The actual frequency of tactical encounters from U.S. forces or allied forces in given areas is relatively limited, but any of you have been in the Baghdad or any of the cities in Iraq realize that it's pretty impossible for anybody to move without having a clash or at least a moment of tension in a given day with U.S. or allied forces. So you always have to put these things in context, and I think often our attitudes in dealing with these issues are not the ones that people think of. The data are not public, but for example, both the 82nd Airborne and the 10th Mountain did surveys in Afghanistan in great depth and found that the amount of fear and hostility based on what is a much more limited contact with U.S. forces is still very significant. And the polls are very similar inside Iraq that are conducted privately by U.S. forces.
Back, standing.
Thanks. So Will Marshall, Progressive Policy Institute. Have you asked Iraqis what they think about the American decision to invade? That is, elicit some sense of whether they thought life would be better had we not done that, or if Saddam Hussein were still in power?
Yeah, we do have that question asking, I think that bottom line question that I presented, asking Iraqis if they think it was right or wrong fundamentally for the United States to invade Iraq. And in our most recent asking, 49%, just under half of the population said it was right. That was an increase from 37% when we asked it in August. It had been around up and down as the conditions in the country have changed. There is, as you can imagine, very, again, stark ethno-sectarian differences in which Kurds are thrilled, Sunnis are devastated, and Shiites are overall pleased but don't want us to stick around too long.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to take one last question. We've already kept Gary for a while, but second row.
Yeah. Joe Gildenhorn, Woodrow Wilson Center. Has there been any polling since the operation in Basra, Maliki's operation there, and what the attitude of the Iraqis would be?
Yeah, no, these are pretty complicated projects to mount, as you can imagine. We can't pop into the field as we can in the States to track developments on a regular basis. Perhaps Tony's sources in the military may have data I'm not aware of, but we ourselves have not been back in the field since our late February survey. I just would like to mention my email address is gary.langer@abc.com. And if any of you do have any follow-up questions, I'd invite you to drop me a line. I'd be happy to work with you one-on-one.
Let me just conclude. When it comes down to actually doing these pollings, people have tried to do it at a very limited level in real time in combat areas. The problem is the results become almost meaningless because 2 days later, the situation kind of shifted itself. So the U.S. government was doing this. But in a place like Basra, or for example, Sadr City right now, if you took the poll in Sadr City 2 days ago, you probably would have gotten a very different picture because the intensity of the fighting shifted radically. In a place like Basra, it would be very nice to have the polling, but one of your problems is that nobody in Basra at this point, because of the security controls and so on, is yet really aware of what happened. Which means that you'd have to poll people on the basis of what they got from news outside Basra, which I suspect wouldn't be all that revealing. So one, as Gary points out, it's not only a matter of marshaling the polls, but while the United States and other countries use these tools at a very refined level, there are really limits to what you can do at any given moment. With that, ladies and gentlemen, let me A, thank you for coming, and B, ask all of you to provide the usual thanks to Gary.